PG Alice.
The government has expressed confidence that a new deal with the EU will be announced in the coming week, improving the trade of food and drink products. The EU Relations Minister, Nick Thomas-Symonds, also said he was pushing for British holidaymakers to have to spend less time in border queues at airports and ports. He told Sunday with Laura Kunzberg on BBC One that any scheme which allowed more freedom for young people to come to the EU would be consistent with getting net migration down. He was asked whether the agreement would cut red tape for food businesses and reduce prices at the supermarkets.
We are confident, but as I say, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. But we promised in our manifesto last year that we were elected on that we would be seeking that agreement across agricultural products to help our farmers export their excellent produce, but also across food and drink. Okay.
The Conservatives have criticised the potential loss of any Brexit freedoms. The Vatican has said that the Pope will meet the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Rome this afternoon. Mr. Zelensky attended the Pontiff's inaugural Mass in St. Peter's Square this morning, which marked the official start of his papacy. The ceremony began with prayers at the tomb of St. Peter inside the Basilica, with the Mass being celebrated in the square outside. Figures from the Ukrainian Air Force indicate Russia launched its biggest ever drone attack on Ukraine overnight. One woman was killed and three other people were injured. The operation comes ahead of a phone call tomorrow between Presidents Trump and Putin. The health authorities in Gaza say dozens of people have been killed in another wave of Israeli strikes. They say all public hospitals in the northern Gaza Strip are now out of service. A doctor at the Indonesian hospital said the facilities had collapsed and he'd had to leave the complex. The new Israeli offensive is continuing even as negotiations on a ceasefire are being held in Qatar. The government says it's consulting on a range of measures for how artificial intelligence companies can use artists' content, which it hopes will work for both the technology and the creative sectors. Sir Elton John has said that allowing AI firms to use artists' work for free would amount to theft on a high scale. He has threatened to take the government to court over the matter. The weather, a generally sunny afternoon across the UK for most of us, possibly heavy and thundery showers will develop. Later in southwest Scotland, top temperatures of 22 Celsius in Belfast, 19 in London and 17 in Edinburgh. That's the BBC News. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Philip Hoare is an award-winning writer whose books often describe the lure of the sea, the strange and beautiful creatures that live in it, and the inspiration that artists have found in its murky depths. His book Leviathan won the Samuel Johnson Prize. It drew on his lifelong obsession with whales, from the giant skeletons in the Natural History Museum in London to his own encounters with them in the wild. His most recent book, William Blake and the Sea Monsters of Love, traces Blake's enduring influence on numerous poets, writers, filmmakers and musicians. He's also written about Noel Coward, the British socialite Stephen Tennant and the Netley Military Hospital on Spike Island near Southampton. We're going to hear Prokofiev, Britain, Copeland, but I think you're starting with waters, if not at the sea, the Blue Danube.
Yes, it's a really deep childhood memory for me because we didn't have a lot of records in our family. My father, though, was a great classical fan, and it was de rigueur to listen to the New Year's Day concert from Vienna. So after my father died, my mother and I would dance to the Blue Danube around the sitting room. And then it was the very eerie beginning of Stanley Kubrick's film 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was a big influence on me and many of us. I mean, it's really where science fiction films started. But the balletic beginning of this film, the first 25 minutes of that film have no dialogue whatsoever. And of course, this is when we first seen the Earth from space and the way these spaceships were dancing around the planet.
Thank you.
The Blue Danube from Space Odyssey by Johann Strauss, performed by the Vienna Opera Orchestra, conducted by Peter Falk. Bring to mind your dancing with your mama.
Yeah, and also the sequence in the film where the spaceship, which is a long sort of spindle shape, cuts to the cabin of the interior, and there's a pen floating in zero gravity, and the stewardess, who has Velcro on her shoes so she can walk through the cabin, gives it to the scientist.
You were born, Philip, in Southampton, nearly on a submarine, I gather.
Yeah, my father, for some unknown reason, took my mother on a tour of a submarine in Portsmouth Harbour. And she started to feel labour pains when she went down into the belly of the submarine. So I sort of connected that with my, you know, I lived next to the sea, but I had such a fear of it. And the idea of a submarine, this sort of almost like this mechanical sea monster, sort of tied with stories my mother told me of the bath in which she was bathed as a child, which her father, my grandfather, I never knew him, but he'd painted a great spouting whale along the side of this big Victorian bath. And I connected all these things with this sort of very deep fear. I never learned to swim until I was 33 and I was living in landlocked London. I swam this morning at 3 o'clock in the dark in Southampton water, which I do very often. So that the fact of living in a place where you could hear the sea, you could hear the foghorns, you could hear the gulls, and yet to be scared of it, it was a strange, strange thing.
But actually probably a healthy thing, because the sea is both wonderful and incredibly dangerous.
Absolutely. One does well to be in awe of it. Although what I've found nowadays is that a lot of children aren't used to sea swimming, and I do feel sorry that modern health and safety dictates that you've got to be very careful and very apprehensive of the sea, as though it's some great monster will rise up and drag you in, rather than support you. I mean, I learned to swim in Haggerston Baths in Hackney, and this elderly woman, she must have been in her 80s, if not her 90s, wearing a boned swimsuit like Esther Williams, you know, and a rubber cap with daisies on it. And she saw me floundering about in the shallow end of this old Edwardian pool, and she literally took me under her water wings. Mm. And what she did, she taught me to break the kind of membrane of the water surface, to put my face in the water, and showed me that you're not going to drown, you're not going to die. You know, the water bears you up. And I bless her every moment of my life, really.
Was it a big family in Southampton?
It was. We were a big Catholic family. There were 6 children, myself, 3 brothers and 2 sisters. I come in the middle, so I'm the last of 4 boys. My father worked in a factory. He was a cable tester. It was actually Pirelli General. Most people associate them with tyres, but they used to make huge undersea cables, which were made in this factory. My father was testing them, and they'd be unwound over a gantry and then straight into a ship. And that was another, for me, a connection, this water, this strange notion of these cables. And I knew that they were transatlantic cables, sort of tethering us to America.
What was it like as a teenager growing up in Southampton in the 70s?
Well, it didn't offer an awful lot of opportunities for someone with my ambitions.
What were your ambitions then?
Well, I was always dressing up. Mm. I always wanted to be someone else, what we called a Red Indian in those times. My father had to take me aside because I was out in the road outside our house in a loincloth made from a strip of red sort of satin material and a belt and a feather hairdress and nothing else. And my father had to take some, it's not really quite, you know, not quite decent, you know. I was drawn to the past very much. Where I went to school was an old Regency villa, and Jane Austen lived in Southampton, and she was a visitor to this house, and I was taught by monks. Being taught by Catholic monks was really fun. They were very eccentric people, so we were kind of eccentric schoolboys, actually, and it was an all-boys school. I always had this passion for the 1920s, and I used to go to school in clothes I'd found in jumble sales, like a big Astrakhan fur-collared coat, a cane with a silver band on it and a horn handle, and a trilby, making my way across the playing fields. That was the way I came to school. You know, through the mud, and any other school, people would just be taking the Michael out of you, you know, but there it was a bit like If. I don't know if you remember the Lindsay Anderson film, If. It was slightly anarchic.
I'm not surprised from what you've said that you wanted to go to art college.
Yeah, I mean, because when I left school, I had very bad results. I got an E in English A-level.
Isn't that so interesting, though? Because, you know, we all pay so much attention to these results. Yeah. But actually, many people are late developers and, you know, can turn out wonderful things a few years later.
I've published 10 books now. So I left college and I didn't get a university place. And my parents, being Catholics, were quite worried because I wanted to go to art college. And they thought I'd get into sex and drugs and rock and roll if I did something like that. So they organised for me to go to Strawberry Hill in Teddington, which was a teacher training college. I spent 3 years there, but the May before I actually left school, I went to see David Bowie play at the Empire Pool in Wembley, which was a swimming pool. And it was as though it was just me and him in this great, vast, empty, benthic, oceanic space. And he came out dressed as if for a Weimar cabaret, in a black waistcoat, white suit and evening trousers with a satin stripes down the side of him. And his hair, he was like a comet. His hair was gold, fading back to fiery red. And he had a packet of gitane in the pocket of his... He was the very god to me, very androgynous. And seeing him sing as if to me alone, I felt as though it was just me and him in there. And then as I came out, there were members of a group called Susie and the Banshees. They were a big punk group at the time. And they were the nascent punk band. And I could see, wow, something's happening here. They're Bowie's children and they're taking it a step further.
You mentioned cabaret, Philip, and it's music from that that we're going to hear next.
Absolutely, and that really ties in. Susie Sue from the Banshees, she was like a character from Cabaret.
Welcome and bienvenue, welcome, fremde. Étranger, stranger, glücklich zu sehen, just wie enchanté. Happy to see you, bleibe reste stehen. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome im cabaret, au cabaret, tu cabaret.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, comment ça va? Do you feel good? Ich bin euer conférencier.
I am your host und sage willkommen, bienvenue. Welcome im cabaret, au cabaret, zu cabaret.
Leave your troubles outside. So, life is disappointing. Forget it. In here, life is beautiful. The girls are beautiful. Even the orchestra is beautiful. Christine, Mausi, Helga, Betty und Inge. Each and every one a virgin. You don't believe me? Well, do not take my word for it. Go ahead. Ask Helga.
Hallo, Stranger.
Glücklich zu sehen. Je suis enchanté.
Enchanté, madame.
Happy to see you. Bleibe rechte stehen. Wir sagen willkommen. Bienvenue. Welcome im Kabarett. Oh, Kabarett. Du Kabarett.
I've been known to reenact that whole opening sequence with my Joel Grey impersonation. Even the orchestra is beautiful. Just that film was and the music, which I had the soundtrack of, and Liza Minnelli with her divine decadence when she wraps her fingernails, which are painted green, around the door as she's entering. It's just amazing. Other world that it offered, you know, in here everything is beautiful. It was my dream, really.
Well, before we heard Philip Hoare, we heard Joel Grey singing Willkommen from the original 1972 cabaret film, the soundtrack conducted by Ralph Burns and composed by John Kander, and the lyricist Fred Ebb. You wrote a biography of the playwright and actor Noel Coward. Was that an excuse to revisit those interwar years?
Absolutely. And I mean, Coward, who was a shining exemplar of that cabaret decadence. I mean, his first play, The Vortex, depicted a young man in love with an elder woman, and he became addicted to cocaine.
His sort of aristocratic manners were learnt, weren't they? I mean, he actually preferred boiled eggs to oysters.
Absolutely. And his background was very similar to mine. I mean, a very suburban boy. He liked to go to bed with a little eggy something on a tray, you know. And he never smoked a cigarette with a cigarette holder. He smoked it in his fist, quite tightly clenched. But yeah, the dressing gown, the slicked back hair, the effortless bon mot, connections to everyone. And the fact that he was the highest earning author in the Western world in 1931.
Who did you meet in the course of the research?
Wonderful people. Most preeminently for me was 3 hours spent with Katharine Hepburn in her house in the Upper East Side in New York. She invited me to come at 9 o'clock in the morning, this was, and her butler, as it were, took me up. Katharine Hepburn was sitting at the back of the house there at private residence gardens, and she was framed in profile against the kind of light coming in from those gardens. And it created this kind of halo around her. It could not be anyone else, that mass of curly hair, aristocratic chin. And she'd staged it. It was like it was being lit by George Cukor, you know. 3 hours later, I was still there. And at one point, I knew she had a portrait of herself by Cecil Beaton. And she said, oh, yes, it's coming. She had a wobbly voice like that, oh, Mr. Hoare. And she took me up to her bedroom. And I'm standing in Katharine Hepburn. There's her clothes lying around in the bedroom. And this portrait of her by Cecil Beaton is on the mantelpiece. And then as we were going downstairs, she showed me a photograph of Spencer Tracy, who was supposedly her great lover. And I said, oh, yes, Miss Hepburn, my mother loves Spencer Tracy. And she began to cry. And then she took me downstairs and she had a very harried-looking secretary called Constance, who had been a friend of Noel Coward's too. And she would bark instructions at this. And she would, now, Constance, tell Mr. Hoare all your friendship with Noel. And she, this woman, she was rather, I don't even remember, Barry Humphries had Madge. It was just like Katharine Hepburn's Madge. And then Katharine Hepburn led me down to the kitchen where there's one of those huge American fridges. And she opened the door and took out a can of half-eaten crab meat, you know, asked me if I was hungry. I looked at this, I thought, minor English writer dies of food poisoning in Katharine Hepburn's brownstone house. But she was so generous and so beautiful. And I was so caught up in this moment that when I left, I actually had to make my excuses and leave because I thought I was just overstaying my welcome. I'd spent the whole morning there and I knew she was going to her home in Connecticut. So when I left, I hid behind a tree on the other side of the road and I waited for her to come out. And it's so funny because the butler, who also deputed as the chauffeur, big black guy, very long-suffering, walks out, starting up the car. And then the secretary comes out being shouted at, you know, with papers flying. And then Katharine Hepburn sails out like a galleon. She had almost a veil behind her. It was a movie. You know, the last I saw of her was vanishing up the road towards Fifth Avenue, and again, her profile through the back window of the car. It was a really amazing thing.
Philip, you moved to London and worked for Virgin and Rough Trade Records.
I had a really exciting time. I was buyer for the independent chain of Virgin stores. There was 24 stores around the country at that point. It's quite a powerful position for someone who was not even 20. And then from then on, I went to Rough Trade Records, which was a very famous independent record label. They had bands like The Smiths and Aztec Camera and Scritti Blitti, New Order. I was also into the art. I designed record sleeves for them, then started up my own record label. London at that point was such an exciting place.
And David Bowie was a big influence.
A huge influence, as he was on all music at that point. The punks were Bowie's children, and he kind of showed the way. The thing about Bowie is that he allowed you to realise your ambitions. You could make music yourself, or you could create yourself as an artist. He removed the limitations around having a career like that or expressing yourself creatively. For my generation, there is no one more important.
You saw him in 76. Is it from that period that you've chosen the next track?
It is. It's actually very soon after that, 1977, the album Low. My very favourite Bowie period is when he was living in Berlin and he was looking like someone from one of those cabarets. And then he was melding that with avant-garde music, electronic music.
Brian Eno.
Brian Eno was producing these three albums, the Berlin Trilogy, Low, Heroes and Lodger. The second side of Heroes and Low were just instrumentals. And it was incredibly radical. I mean, that was a marriage made in heaven, because Eno's very avant-garde aesthetic really melded with Bowie's showmanship to create music which was almost oceanic. They're soundscapes. They take you to other places.
Thank you.
Art Decade from the 1977 album Low by David Bowie. One of your other biographies, Serious Pleasures, is about the socialite Stephen Tennant. And I wondered whether it was the same element of extrovert maverick which attracted you to him.
Very much so. Stephen Tennant, who is the son of Lord Glenconner, he was a great aesthete, but he was also an artist. He made himself into an art object. He had gold dust sprinkled in his hair, Vaseline on his eyelids. He wore a coat modelled on his brother's First World War flying jacket, only it had a chinchilla fur collar. And Caroline Blackwood said he was the David Bowie of their time, you know. And he had this big affair with Siegfried Sassoon, the war poet, and was much photographed by Cecil Beaton. In my work, I've always loved the idea of time travelling, that writing allows you to travel through time and you can put these people in the same room. It's almost like an impossible cocktail party.
He went to bed for 17 years, so he didn't go out to cocktail parties during that time.
No, he didn't, because as his beauty faded, he couldn't quite come to terms with that. And in fact, he was still in the same bed when I actually met him in 1987. And Stephen, by this time, was living alone. This huge arts and crafts manor. His housekeeper showed me through these great warren of rooms with papers scattered across the floor. I later learned there were letters from Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster and Cecil Beaton. And then she took me into a room off to one side, and it was such a contrast because it was just one bare electric light bulb, an electric fire, you know, those electric bar fires, and then Stephen lying in a blue satin bed, and he was like a Buddha. He was enormously big, long hennaed hair down to a kind of straggling ponytail. He was wearing two shirts, and then over his legs, a rug made of what I later learned were 22 skins from a very rare Columban monkey. And he extended his hand to me and he said, "How do you do?" with the voice of an Edwardian hostess. And this hand, which had held Siegfried Sassoon's and Virginia Woolf and Willa Cather and Tallulah Bankhead, it was the most astonishing thing, this physical connection to that world I'd idolised as a boy. I was standing now with someone who was like the almost covert, almost secret, preserved icon of that. He's now entirely different, the way he looked. I showed him a photograph. I'd written an article about him for the Observer newspaper, and they put one of the Beaton photographs of him on the cover, and I, you know, showed him this. He said, "Oh, look at me. Aren't I beautiful? Take it to the window so you can see it better." And he said, "Do people still talk about me in London?" As though that whole world still existed.
That book led you to friendship with the filmmaker John Waters.
It did.
Another cult figure.
Very much so. He's my literary godfather. He reviewed the book for the New York Times. It completely made me. So John, who was a great progenitor of punk too in his films, is very radical.
Pink Flamingos. Female Trouble, Crybaby.
That's right.
Hairspray.
Yeah, I mean, he's the first person to give people like Johnny Depp their first starring role in a film. John has been my radical touchstone. And so when I went to visit him in Provincetown at the end of Cape Cod, at the very tip of Cape Cod, a great big sandy peninsula held out into the Atlantic, quite close to Boston in New England, it's where John has written all his films. And I suddenly realised this was a place where you could see whales. And I'd seen a captive orca in Windsor Safari Park, which is now Legoland, back in the early 70s, performing like a circus animal. And I realised what human beings did to these animals. So when I visited John in Provincetown, which was a whaling port in the days, in Melville's days, and I went out in a whale watch boat almost reluctantly because I thought it was going to be another kind of circus act. And then this 40-foot, 40-ton humpback whale breached right in front of me with these flippers, you know, 15 foot long. It was like a coup de foudre. In fact, I uttered a very rude word because I was so shocked. And this beautiful, eerie, unknown animal, sentient, looking at me with this eye. I mean, a whale's eye is really salutary because it's, you know, it's reading you. It's, you know, this eye has a big brain behind it.
I think it was Copland whose music actually really reminds you of that time on Cape Cod.
Very deeply, because of the kind of almost utopian sense of New England as a brave new world. And the Shaker song, which ties me back to my Catholic faith, the purity of the Shaker vision, which is again ultra modern, and this beautiful, beautiful song.
Thank you.
Simple Gifts from Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, performed by the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by John Wilson.
It's just such a beautiful piece of music, and it lifts the heart. It makes me think about huge beaches, deep woods in which coyotes and wild turkeys stalk, and the promise, really, of the natural world is a paradise. My heart really is partly there.
And if you're lucky, you see a whale even from the beach. Are they named? I mean, often inspired by their markings?
That's right. The humpback whales particularly have a black and white pattern on the underside of their flukes, the tail fins, and it's an abstract pattern. So they get their name, you know, they might be called Tornado or Anchor. Famous whale called Anchor. She's a great-grandmother and she has a anchor-shaped space there. So they become personae.
Let's actually hear the sound of whales. It's an incredibly haunting sound.
So this is a recording by Roger Payne, The Songs of the Humpback Whales, and this came out at the same time as 2001, the Space Odyssey soundtrack. The whale's voice is what saved the whale, because we realised they were cultural beings like us. And that's the start of all those big environmental movements, Save the Whale, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace. They're all founded on that sense that how can we lose these animals about whom we know so little? Intelligent, sentient, trans-global. They exist in the greater majority of the world. Most of our planet is water. And that's why it was the blue planet that you saw in 1968 was the blueness of the Earth. And so I met Roger Payne, who recorded this sound, and he said it was the sound as big as the ocean. So off the Pacific coast of Mexico, I was taken out by some scientists on a little boat into the bay. I thought you had to be in the water to hear that sound. The surface of the ocean is one loudspeaker. It resonates through the water. And I asked the captain if I could stick my head in through the water, be like that woman who taught me to swim, and suddenly, wham, you're in it. And I hung upside down with my feet up to the surface, my head down below. I was like a human hydrophone. And the sound of the whale echoed round the whole of my body. It filled me, the deepness, those bass notes. And quite amusingly, I realised that when you hear the notes going quite high, the whale is running out of air, so it's going... Actually, to do a whale song, hold your nose and you hum. And as they're coming up to the top, it goes, starts going... It gets higher and higher. And then suddenly the whale splats, comes out, takes a breath, and then starts the whole thing again. But the physical connection, because sound moves 5 times faster in water than it does in the air. So a whale is connected to other whales by sound, not by vision.
Over quite long distances too.
Very long distances. A whale on one side of the Atlantic can be heard by a whale on the other side of the Atlantic. It's been recorded, a fin whale actually, in the Caribbean being detected by a fin whale off the coast of Ireland.
And they do extraordinary things like bubble netting, where they'll make a circle, blow bubbles in order to feed. I mean, real intelligence going on there.
Absolutely. And when you see that happening, and I've seen that many, many times off Cape Cod, it's culture happening before you. The way the animals call one another in when they find a big patch of fish, but the way they relate to one another in a familial way. Home to a whale is other whales.
How has the music of whales changed over the last 100 years? And indeed, how has their population changed?
Well, hugely. By virtue of the fact of the amount of noise that we humans are pumping into the ocean. if you imagine that when Melville wrote Moby Dick back in 1850, there was almost no anthropogenic noise in the ocean. 50 years later, steam engines come in. And then what we have now with seismic surveys for oil, military sonar use, the sheer volume of transoceanic traffic is deafening for these animals. You know, for animals which exist in a world of sound, that's a huge problem for them.
You wrote about your obsession in Leviathan, which won the Samuel Johnson Prize for nonfiction in 2009. Leviathan was also inspired by Melville's Moby Dick. And Melville grew up in quite an affluent family, but fortunes changed and he sought a new life at sea. And I think his first trip was to Liverpool.
It was indeed. Not many people know that, yeah. And that was really the beginning of his life as a sailor, which he was a rather diffident sailor. He wasn't really into it. He'd escaped being a teacher in New England and really didn't know what he was doing with his life. He is the character of Ishmael. He doesn't really know what to do, so he'll go to sea. And then has these extraordinary adventures. And Melville ended up living amongst what he called cannibals and the Marquesas Islands, right in the middle of the Pacific, and then had this great whaling expedition. The fate of the whale was also mirrored for him in the terrible progress of what was leading up to the American Civil War. The same ships that were being used for slavery were the same ships that were being used for whaling. So there was a kind of equivalence about these two very exploitative, inhuman industries. That's the power of Moby Dick, is that Melville tells those stories, which are quite boys' own adventures to gender them, but turns them into the most metaphysical metaphors for our lives. I mean, he's drawing on Shakespeare, he's drawing on John Milton, he's drawing on his own experience and creating a science fictional world, which is very much like that of 2001.
It's another Melville book which inspired our next music.
Absolutely. It's the book that took me into Melville, funny enough. It was Billy Budd, Melville's final novella. It wasn't published within Melville's lifetime. It was found, the manuscript was found in a bread tin in his desk after he died. Very powerful story. It's the backstory to Moby Dick, really. It's set during the Napoleonic Wars. Billy Budd, an impressed seaman, this handsome sailor, except he has one flaw, his stutter. And Britain's opera, written by E.M. Forster, encapsulates that strangeness of Melville's world, which is sort of psychosexual in many ways. You know, the idea of what Billy Budd represents to the crew of the ship that he's been impressed upon. That suppressed power that Britain conveys so well is really implicit.
Which bit have you chosen?
Act two, when Billy is being brought onto this ship and the sailors are scrubbing the deck and they're singing this song. They are suppressed and oppressed by their masters, and they're all in love with Billy Budd.
Thank you.
Music from Act Two of Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd, Blow Her Away, performed by the Halle Orchestra and the Gentlemen of Their Choir, with Northern Voices, conducted by Kent Nagano. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the writer, Philip Hall. Philip, your fascination with Wales also led to the Moby Dick Big Read. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, unlike the US, where Moby Dick is required reading at high school, hardly anyone's read it here, you know. It's a very intimidating book, 136 chapters of everything you ever wanted to know and a lot of it you didn't want to know about Wales. So myself and the artist Angela Cocaine, we had this idea of reading it for people. And the great thing about Moby Dick is each of those chapters, they're discrete plots within themselves, so they work as standalone readings, each of the chapters, the way that Melville writes. Oh, it's almost biblical. And so we invited various people to read it, people like Tilda Swinton, Sir David Attenborough, Stephen Fry, Benedict Cumberbatch, Fiona Shaw, a great sort of starry cast list to bring it to life. And it was hugely successful. It had 10 million hits. It's still going, you know, you can hear it now. And it's free to listen to and you can hear the whole of the book read for you.
We heard Billy Budd just now, and your next piece was written in memory of Benjamin Britten, wasn't it?
Yeah, by Arvo Pärt. It's a very beautiful, austere memoriam for Britten. It has a little bit of the pureness, I suppose, of some of those tracks that Bowie recorded with Eno, but that it also has a sense of quietude, which reminds me of my faith as a Catholic, and I still go to church. I don't know what I believe about it, but there's something quite reliquary about this piece of music.
It consists of a simple idea which is then treated in quite a complex way. Lots of descending strings, grieving, if you like, and then the only other instrument is a very telling bell.
Yeah. It's very like Britten's War Requiem. That bell, I've just spent 2 days in Paris in an apartment above Shakespeare and Company, and Notre Dame's bells were tolling the whole time for Pope Francis. And the power of bells is really almost primitive sound.
Well, I was thinking it's whale-like in a sense.
It is.
It changes the atmosphere.
Yeah, you feel it in the air.
Thank you.
Cantus in Memoriam Benjamin Britten, the Tapiola Sinfonietta, conducted by Jean-Jacques Kantorov. Philippot, you're drawn to the way artists see and interpret the natural world. In Albert and the Whale, you examined Dürer's fascination with natural history and how his images feed into our collective imagination. And, of course, Dürer travelled all over the place to see unusual creatures.
He certainly did. I mean, his rhinoceros, which everyone will know, I think, it appears on shopping bags and bottles of wine now. It's an iconographic image of a whale, of an animal. He said a whale because I associate it with actually this misbegotten attempt of his to try and draw a whale. He heard there was a stranded whale off the coast of Zeeland in the Low Countries, and it's almost as though he was too ambitious. You know, he was pushing himself too far. The whale was washed away before he got to it, but he caught malaria instead, which eventually killed him.
It's the almost South African national anthem now, isn't it?
It is. I had an amazing experience in South Africa in 1993, before the all-race elections, time of great trauma and trepidation. And my friend Mark Ashurst was the world business reporter for the World Service there. And he was working for an ANC voter education trust. So we went into the townships. And it was, you know, I'd fought all my life. I marched with lots of other people against apartheid and protested. And to see how close to destruction that country came at that point. It was a violent time. But then Mandela, Madiba, the father, as they called him, what he did for that country and did for the world, what one person can do by representing a whole state, a whole way of feeling, a need for change. So in Kozi Sikelele, Africa, that was really the soundtrack of that time.
Kozi Sikelele, Africa. Maluphaka Yesu dumolwayo yizwa yemethandazo yethu kosi sikelela
sikelela
thina lusapho lwayo kosi sikelele Afrika. Malupaka Yesu pondolwayo yizwa yemithandazo yethu kosi sikelela
sikelela
thina lusapho lwayo
woza
moya woza woza
woza
woza moya woza moya woyi gcwele kusi sikelele thina lusapho lwayo morena buluka sishaba sa Yesu uvelise dintwali maswenyeho morena buluka sishaba sa Yesu uvelise dintwali maswenyeho usibuluke
usibuluke morena
usibuluke sishaba sa Yesu sishaba sa Afrika, magu benjalo, kute kubenguna pakati.
When I was in South Africa, we went to a place called Unu, which was where Nelson Mandela's family home was and where he was living. And I took this photograph from the road of the house. And about 6 months later, I was in London and I got introduced to Mandela. I'd taken along these photographs to show him. This ridiculous thing, showing him photographs of his own house. And, oh, my God, the handshake of this man it was like a Michelangelo moment where there's touching this person's hand. And he saw me again the next day. He must have thought I was stalking him. And he pointed at me and said, "You." And I got a letter from his daughter after that thanking me for the photographs. I mean, the gentility, the elegance of this person.
And Chiozzi Sicilelli Africa with the Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Filippo, do you have a particular writing process, a time of day when you write? I mean, after all, if you're up swimming at 3 o'clock, it could follow that, I suppose.
That's exactly when I write. And I find swimming really kickstarts my brain. Writing is so sedentary. So to get out of bed, cycle down to the beach, swim in ebony black sea and shiver and then scrabble to get your clothes back. Your brain is going crazy, partly because it's saying, oh, so we're not going to die now then. It's kind of like recovering. So your brain's firing on all cylinders, and that's my golden moment, really. Also, no one can get at you. No one generally rings you at that time of day. So there's a kind of purity and a flow of the sea. I often write to the rhythm of the sea, maybe even the rhythm of my swimming stroke. Like this morning in the sea, there was bioluminescence. They're zooplankton, actually, and they spark like stars in the sea, shooting up. I mean, I know it sounds very romantic, but it's truth. And this sense of this hugeness which connects us all. It recognises no boundaries. It's deeper than we can imagine. Would poetry exist without the sea? This profoundness, this deepness that is the kind of reservoir of our aspirations and our fears, our hopes. I mean, now more than ever, because the sea is rising. So that sense of our own future and our past reflected in it.
Your most recent book is William Blake and the Sea Monsters of Love. Why did you want to write about him?
I realised he's been there a lot in my work. I wrote a book called England's Lost Eden, which was about a utopian sect in the New Forest in the 1870s. Blake really came into that because of his utopian aspects of his work. When I lived in the East End in London, I walked over his grave every day in Bunhill Fields. I sort of wanted to apologise for that in a way. Because, like Bowie, he is transgenerational. His aesthetic is all-encompassing.
And what I loved about the book, actually, was the way you talk about the long-lasting influence of him on writers and artists like Derek Jarman, Paul Nash, that wonderful painter.
Very much so. It was Blake's language as much as his images that gave him, propelled actually Nash into his very particular brand of English surrealism, which really attracts me because it has a sort of restraint. And in the book, I relate it to his affair with Eileen Agar, the great surrealist artist herself, who was transforming herself into a Blakean body. She's almost like an aquatic figure herself, some of the images she makes of herself. Nash was fascinated by whales. The sea is a surreal place. The animals in it are improbable. An octopus is the most improbable animal, you know. Blake writes about octopuses. He never saw an octopus. You know, his famous image of Newton sitting on a rock. Newton is sitting on the bottom of the sea on a coral reef and is measuring out the world, blithely ignorant of the beauty around him, which will never be measured.
Prokofiev next.
Yeah, Prokofiev. So this is when I had a very sensorily extraordinary visit to Moscow and St. Petersburg when I was representing the British Council there on a tour. This was just when the oligarchs had taken control of the economy. It was like a Wild West city, Moscow. And I went to see a production of The Lover Through Oranges in the theatre next to the Bolshoi. I got very drunk in the intermission because they were giving you free champagne, Russian champagne, and I went back to a front row seat. I just walked to the front. It was kind of slightly anarchic, and there was this spirit about it. And I knew that Prokofiev, the march, you know, from what my father had played, you know, as a child. So just wonderful.
Thank you. Great tune.
Unbeatable, isn't it?
Prokofiev's March from The Love of Three Oranges, performed by the San Paolo Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Marin Alsop. One of your earliest books, Philip, was a biography of a building based in Southampton, Netley, the Victorian Military Hospital, which has an incredible history.
Yeah, it was built during the Crimean War. It was actually the first purpose-built military hospital in the UK. It was ordained by Queen Victoria when the Crimean War was going so badly. There were so many people dying of disease. You know, this is the time of Florence Nightingale. She was asked to advise on the building of this hospital. It was the largest building ever built. It was a whale on the shores of Southampton Water. Florence Nightingale hated it. She said you might as well put 1,000 men in that building each year and shoot them as try and treat them there. It's a very impractical building built to resemble the Palace of Versailles. But the idea of a building containing stories, and this building which was pulled down when I was a boy, I don't remember it, but in my head, it just comes to life because people like Wilfred Owen was treated for shell shock there. Noel Coward entertained the troops. And it's where I swim off the beach in front of this military hospital. And I feel Owen's spirit there, really. And Owen was an important figure, both in that book and in later books I've written.
Well, the next piece takes us back to the sea again.
It does indeed. Cravin O'Ralia, a fiddle player from Ireland who I was introduced to last year in County Wicklow. I was at a festival there called the Shaking Bog, and I've recently discovered my ancestors, where they lived outside Dublin, and the sense of my Irishness, which I so disavowed as a young man. Now I appreciate that, you know, I have quite a deep Irish connection. And so I went to this festival, and Cravin played a song based on a folk song about Wales, and he played it in my honour. Amazingly, he uses a 10-string fiddle with two internal strings. So there's kind of this extraordinary reverb to the sound. I was sitting at the back and I suddenly realised the entire audience were moving as one. They weren't dancing. They weren't even really swaying. They were just almost vibrating to this music which is older than Christianity. It's incredibly atavistic, incredibly emotional, because it's almost been engineered over the centuries to touch the human spirit. Thank you.
You know, Philip Hall, we've been talking about ancient and modern Blake, Brian Eno, and there we had an ancient tune, but given a kind of luminous setting, a modern setting.
Absolutely. The way the sea seems to stain the sky, the ambiguity of moving from night into day. I think that's where a lot of art comes from, where you feel suspended from the earth, suspended from your own body in a way. That's why the sea feeds me as a writer. It's a suspension holding me up from care, from your physical incapacities. You know, the things that you, when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, when you think about the worst things, the sea is the antidote to that for me.
We heard Quivín Orellà playing the fiddle. I think it's called a hardanger fiddle, that particular.
Yes, I think you're right, yes.
With the pianist Thomas Bartlett performing All Good Things. Well, your final piece is by the Pet Shop Boys, partially to do, I imagine, with your friendship with Neil Tennant.
Yeah, I first met Neil in 1983 when he was the assistant editor of Smash Hits magazine, and he was a gawky, thin youth. He reminded me, I saw him a couple of weeks ago, and he reminded me that actually the record that we were plugging to him, he actually did review for Smash Hits. So much later, I met him and became, we're really good friends. He's a big influence on me. You know, it has been like knowing David Bowie in many ways, but someone who actually has outlived Bowie. I mean, Pet Shop Boys' career is much longer than David Bowie's in a way.
Can you put your finger on why you like their music?
Oh, it speaks to my shared experience. I'm pretty much the same age as Neil, of the losses that we've experienced, you know, which is what this song is about, and the glory of living through amazing times.
And he comes up with extraordinary lyrics, doesn't he, too?
His lyrics are incredible.
And which pop group would think of having a song called Being Boring?
I know, it's very counterintuitive. I'm sure their record label said, no, we can't release a single like that. But it's the song that really stands for them now in many ways.
Well, it's catchy, and I think also the harmony of their songs is often very interesting too.
Oh, yeah. Chris Lowe's ability to write extraordinary music. He's the quiet genius.
But he's also the literary part.
Absolutely.
Okay, so, well, let's hear Being Boring from the 1990 album Behaviour by the Pet Shop Boys. And Philip Hall, thank you so very much for playing it.
My absolute pleasure.
We were never beat. Being Boring by the Pet Shop Boys, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the writer Philip Hall. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael's going to be talking to the comedian, writer and podcaster Adam Buxton. Next on Radio 3, Sarah Moore Peach takes us on a journey to the Lark Ascending in Music Map.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
You know, I've composed all my life pretty much, and it's like writing. It comes from the human soul.
I love shaping a piece of music and taking audiences on a journey with that. And as a conductor, you really get the opportunity to do that.
I call it the Holy Trinity. It's my wife, my dog, and my piano.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
It's glorious. It's uplifting, and it makes you think, yes, actually, the world is a decent place. There is hope.
Listen on your radio, on BBC Sounds, and ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3.
Now on Radio 3, as part of Radio 3's programming for BBC Mental Health and Wellbeing Week, it's time for this week's edition of Music Map.
Hello, I'm Sarah Moore Peach. Welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. In each episode of the show, we take a piece of music and create a map of it, connecting it in to a wider world of sound. And there really is an infinite number of possible maps for any given piece, depending on how you turn the kaleidoscope round. So as it's Mental Health and Wellbeing Week, I thought we'd take a very familiar piece of classical music and map it through that particular lens. According to some research which came out a couple of years ago, if you want to listen to music as a way of creating more focus in your mind, regulating your nervous system, and even processing difficult emotions, the optimal length of time to listen is 13 minutes. So for today's destination piece, I've chosen a work that lasts just a fraction more than that. Also, if you Google the most relaxing piece of classical music, this usually comes pretty top of the list. The Lark Ascending by Ralph Vaughan Williams, one of those pieces of music which has taken on a life of its own in the 100 or so years since it was written, and music which many listeners say brings them a sense of well-being. So over the next hour and a half, we'll be wending our way towards that destination through a landscape of connected sounds related not only to mental well-being, but also to musical representations of the natural world, birds in particular. The solo violin in Vaughan Williams' piece mimics the song of a lark, but he also subtitled the piece a romance, so perhaps he had this in mind, one of Beethoven's two romances for violin and orchestra.